Hello, this is Pearl Lamb Podcast, and I am here sitting in Johnny Yeo's studio. It's magnificent, really magnificent. So may I introduce Johnny? And Johnny, can you just give a brief about who you are, what you're out to the audience who is not in the art world?
Okay, so I'm Jonathan Yeo. I have spent 30 years painting. I guess my day job is painting faces, because I find that most interesting. But as you know, I then spend probably half my time experimenting on other things, often also face-related. But that has sometimes been making collages, sometimes making doing works around plastic surgery and people kind of, you know, cosmetic surgery and what people do to change their appearance and the operations, going to watch sort of surgeons operate. And in recent years, I've done a lot of experimenting around technology and new ways of making portraits, but also, you know, everything from immersive experiences to apps to, you know, different kinds of 3D capture, virtual reality, to making sculpture and other things.
Johnny, you are self-taught? Self-taught portrait painter, or have you gone to, you know, who's teaching portrait painting today? There's hardly anybody, you know, hardly have any classes about portrait painting.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny, and people always ask me with a bit of suspicion about being self-taught. And I'm self-taught in the sense that I didn't go and do an art degree. I did painting at school and when I was a kid, and I carried on doing life classes through my sort of early years. But I didn't do an art degree. And part of that was because at that stage, I mean, obviously now in the art world, there's a lot of figurative painting. It's become a much more, you know, mainstream thing again. But in the early 90s, when I was, you know, starting off...
And conceptual. No one teach you how to paint.
Exactly. Yeah. It was really out of fashion. I mean, painting full stop was out of fashion, let alone Absolutely. Figurative, and portraiture was a sort of dirty word.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And I think certainly in Europe, but maybe in China it was different, because I remember when I came to China with you, whatever it was, 10, 15 years ago, and I was really interested in how many of the Chinese contemporary artists were, you know, happily embracing portraiture. They didn't see it as an old-fashioned thing or kind of, you know, as a retro thing.
Because I think China, the syllabus, they follow the Soviet Union syllabus. So they still teach painting, but most of the syllabus around the world, international, Western Europe or America, has taken everything about painting out of the syllabus. Mm. And I was just told that even they are going to take out the drawings from schools. Yeah. So in school, they're no longer going to teach drawings.
How interesting. Even at a time when it's
so
becoming more
sad.
Mainstream.
Yeah. Sad, really sad. I remember when I last had a very long talk with you, you was telling me that you were trying to find these pigments, these colors, which is like the good old, I mean, the old master, like in the Florentine painting thing, and you were trying to find these pigments and how to create those paints. And I think one of the things that you were describing to me was during your plastic surgeon series, you were using these paints and so that you can create that complexion.
Yes, so partly the paints. I mean, I've always been interested in looking at what techniques are not being used currently, whether it's new techniques or sometimes looking back in the past. And one of those things was, yes, using certain colours, but also the mediums used to use. And so, and for those pictures in particular, to get the really, really soft kind of blending of skin tones to make them feel, you know, kind of eerily photographic, I found a technique where the old masters used to add clove oil to slow down the drying times, which was basically so you could, you know, and this is a kind of good hack for artists, but basically, you know, all trouble with oil paint, it's not as bad as acrylic, but it still dries in a few days. And actually, by adding a little bit of a much slower drying oil, you can slow that down to a week or even, you know, a week and
really?
A half,
wow.
Which means you can come in and, you know, keep on working into wet paint. Now, it's got to be used with caution because if you add too much, then the painting never dries, and so it can cause other problems. So you have to have a little dropper and use it very carefully. But it's interesting. You do sometimes by digging around at what other people use or people use for other purposes, for commercial art or other things. You learn you spot things which might be applicable to what you do and solve problems.
Johnny, recently you have, I mean, everywhere we read about you. I mean, with this King Charles portrait. And people either like it or they made really horrible comments about this, you know, red and the King Charles there. They said that, oh, it's coming from hell and all that. You're very calm. You're not affected. I love the painting. I even went there, you sent me to this gallery to see it. When you have people having never, they don't appreciate that this is a contemporary world, right? So a contemporary, of course, is a contemporary interpretation of a portraiture. You're not going to copy a style of like a few hundred years ago to do that. So how are you addressing this? Do you care about what people say?
It's a funny one, because I mean, I think, obviously, when you do a commission of someone who's so much in the public eye as the king is at the moment, especially given everything else going on in his life, you expect a bit of interest. So that wasn't a surprise. Yeah. But the scale of obsession about it was extraordinary. And I think, as you say, I think my work. It isn't very different from the other works I've been doing over the years. I think, but then, of course, for most of the world have an idea of what a royal portrait should be, because a lot of them in recent years have been these very traditional and quite stiff things. And I think the previous queen was not very interested in painting. She preferred photography. And so she was kind of like, I think, that a lot of those pictures feel quite cold and stiff and, kind of slightly retrospective looking in their style and feel. But I think he's different. And he obviously knows my work and wanted me to do my thing with it. And the colour I was trying to... I mean, the colour basically was interesting. People who saw it in the studio, and you've seen it in the flesh. I mean, it's not quite as exaggerated in the flesh. It's a bit more subtle in the flesh than it is in reproduction. And part of that is the nature of digital photography and the way we look at everything on screens, that it exaggerates the primary colours. But also, actually, in the flesh, it's as much pink as red, and there are other colours as well. And so when it all happened... I for the first few hours, firstly, they kind of like, it was everywhere, and that was exciting. And then the next day, you started getting all these comments about it being red, and I was like, hang on, people are missing the point of this, and, all this stuff you think about. And then it just kept going. You think it's going to die down, and it went on for days and days. It was still being discussed weeks later. And I think it was the point about 2 days in where we started getting all these crazy conspiracy theories coming in about it. My daughters are 17 and 20, so they're all over TikTok, and they're picking up all this stuff and sending it to me. And it was like, what? What is this? What is this, like, the satanic symbolism and all this sort of thing? I was thinking,
because it's red, so it's satanic.
And I think, I've learned over the years to expect a certain amount of unexpected interpretation and people projecting their own thoughts onto paintings. But I've never seen anything like this. And I don't think, I'm certainly not in my work. I don't think I've seen it in other people's work so much. But I think it's also an amazing moment in time when, the fact that it kind of was in the, it obviously went in the mainstream media, but also some kind of like, was it, caught the imagination of the sort of the teenagers. It was every generation saw it and argued about it. And as you say, some people loved it, some people hated it, some people, certainly lots of people had different ideas about it. And that was the fun of it. Everyone had felt the same way.
I think the most important thing is you have become a hot number. This is the most relevant point, because, painting, everybody has a point of view. And I think, there's certain expectation, as you said, because they always expected the royal portraiture, but you give it a complete different view. And the king loves it, right? And Camilla love it. And the most important thing is the person who's sitting for it.
Yeah.
Love the painting.
Well, I think so. I think, it's nice what you say. I think in a funny way, it suddenly went from something which was hidden in the studio for many months, and I was very careful about not showing it to people, to something which is completely public property. It was replicated billions of times around the world. I mean, the stats were insane. Reflecting on it afterwards, I think what's lovely is that it's a reminder that a painted picture, a painted portrait, really connects with people in a way that we've got, you know, well, they used to think, you know, we're so used to photography and the saturation of images that we see every day. And actually, you know, we read paintings in a different way, and it can affect us emotionally, clearly, in sometimes more powerfully than anything else.
So, okay, how many times have you met King Charles? So how do you actually pick up his personality and paint? I mean, how many times do you actually meet a sitter to actually be able to paint the personality within the...
And that's what you want. You know, the idea of the painting is, regardless of what else you're doing and what other stories you're telling, you want to make sure you've captured that person and you're getting
and
there.
And that's the most important thing, that capture that person.
Yeah, and you can't do that in one session, because you don't know, you know, they're just in a particular mood that day, or they're, you know, and people have wear masks, and you know, especially when they're sort of, when you meet them for the first time, and often it takes a few sessions to kind of break through that. I usually suggest to people they kind of sit 5 or 6 times. I can still take lots of photos and work on it in between, but it's really important to see them on different days, and that for that relationship between, you know, the artist and sitter to evolve. In his case, obviously, there's always a fight with the busy people to get enough time in the diary, but we did 4 proper sittings. It also helped that I'd met him 6 times before. He'd bought one of my works before. He'd, he commissioned me, and I'd done the portrait of his wife. And so we weren't starting from scratch, I think, which helped a bit. And he's a very easygoing person. You know, he's very, you know, he'll make you laugh. He'll, you know, seems to genuinely want to know about you, and he's curious, and, you know, the conversation's very easy.
He likes art.
And
which
he
is,
art.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, he loves art. This is, yeah. Which is fundamentally, yeah. Which is important.
Exactly. And so I think the sittings were easygoing, and he also let me sit in on a couple of his meetings to watch him doing other things, which is always interesting. And so it was just enough, I think, to get a feel for who he was, which I hope I did, and get a sense of human being amidst all the kind of craziness of the world he's in.
You're a portrait painter. So what is the most important thing as a successful portrait painter to capture?
Well, I think a bit of it you kind of pick up over the years on, you know, you accidentally learn by sometimes getting it wrong, you know, and what you work out a way of allowing them to sort of show you who they are. And then you try and show some of it in their face. You obviously make decisions about, you know, what they're doing in the picture and what the composition is and where they're looking and that sort of thing to help. And you know, how you light it is very important. And then sometimes you can add in elements of narrative. I don't like paintings that are too complicated with other stories and, you know, other things going on, but to have a few little sort of clues as to who someone is can be interesting as well. If their clothes are important to them, then you include that. I mean, I often, if I don't think their clothes are important, I sometimes kind of leave them out altogether. You know, and so I think you edit out what's really relevant to that person, and hope that the judgments you're making are the same things that other people will recognize.
You know, recently I've been very interested in African art. So what I find out is when I go to Africa, everybody is doing figurative. Mm. Everyone. I mean, sometimes every day you see so many face, head and all that, you just cannot see one from another. So what makes, what makes you different, Johnny, is when we come and see, you know, you have this pale face and the color that you use and all that. So it gives you a very different signature, characteristic of what you do. So since when did you have that? Has you created that?
It's a good question. I think I evolved it over time, and it may also be partly because I wasn't ever taught a method for doing it.
You find your language yourself.
Yeah. And I think that, partly this is like one of the things I do. I think the kind of what people would recognize is the fact that I focus on some areas and not others and leave some suggested or abstract. Now, that's partly because that's the way I remember images. You know, when I sort of remember a scene or a person, I don't remember it all in photographic detail. I remember certain elements that are important. You know, I was doing you now. Obviously, the face is the most important part because that we as humans, we pick up so much information from the face about, you know, who you are and what's going, you know, what mood you're in and what's going to happen next and what you're thinking and all that sort of thing, all the kind of non-verbal communication. But also your body language is very important. I don't need every bit of detail, but to see exactly where your shoulders are in relation to your head and how you're sat also tells you know, we pick up a lot of information from that too. And then your clothes, obviously, and how you do your hair is what you're projecting, and so that's relevant. And then possibly a little bit of the, you know, architecture and the sort of sense of what the space you're in might be important, might not be. But those are the sort of, on the sort of scale of importance, really, what I pick up on. And then anything that's not important, I try to leave out. I think we also, I mean, I certainly like images where it's not completely realist and in focus, because I think to have a little bit left to the imagination also makes a work more intriguing.
And makes you go back to it. More intriguing, absolutely.
And maybe on a different day, you see it in a different way. And so it becomes a slightly more living thing. And then the distorted colours are, I think, was sort of something I initially did slightly by accident, by reusing canvases. But then I found that actually I preferred it to when I made them, you know, very lifelike. And I think there's something about the fact, you know, you are doing a painting. You're not, it's not real life. You are making something which is a representation of someone. And to acknowledge that it is, you're not trying to make it real, in a way, you know, I think makes it a more interesting game you play with the viewer.
I mean, you do paint, but why collages? And why porn? You know, why porn and why collages? Of course, porn is very, very current. Every generation, you have porn. But why collages? From painting to collages.
So the collages started because, well, there were two things going on. One was that I'd offered, so a lot of the paintings, some of them end up, you know, with a slightly sort of broken up style, especially the older faces. But very often they'd start in this, you know, it's partly because when I was teaching myself to paint by going and looking at other artists' work, one of the periods I really loved was the sort of cubists and sort of, you know, kind of early expressionist paintings. And so that work influenced my own painting early on. And I'd still, to this day, if I'm working very fast or doing an initial study of a face or figure, will paint in that sort of, you know, kind of way that looks like, you know, a bit of a patchwork. And so I thought one day, well, it would suit collage. And then, of course, the natural kind of progression of thinking is, well, if you're making a collage of human faces and bodies, then the obvious, you know, medium to use is pornographic magazines, because it's all skin tones. So I had this idea, but then there wasn't a particular reason to use it, because I didn't think any of my sort of normal portrait subjects would thank me for making a collage of them out of porn instead. But I had this commission, which was for President Bush, which is in nearly 20 years ago now, which I'd started, and they'd got in touch with me about. And
how did you and Bush connect it?
Well, and in the end, I never met him. They came to me about doing this commission for the Bush Library, Presidential Library, and I had to send all this information about me and answer all these questions and send these preparatory sketches and stuff. So I was looking at all these images of him. And then when he won his second term, it kind of went quiet and they wouldn't return the calls and everything. And I was thinking, oh, well, yeah, I've wasted my time on this. So it sat on the shelf for a while. And then one day I thought, well, actually, let's have a go at the collage. And that would be, I don't mind doing it of him, because I don't really care if I upset him or the people who commissioned it.
So you used the pawn.
Exactly. And the initial idea was to, if it went well, I didn't think it would take very long, which I was wrong about. It was very slow, because you have to sort of basically make all the decisions you make doing a painting.
The colour
and then
tone.
Do it all over again with finding the pieces of paper in the magazines that match the colours, and preferably ones where you can also see a little bit of detail of what's going on, so you know it's from pornographic magazine. Otherwise, you lose the fun of that. So it took a long time, but actually it turned out better than I expected. And my idea was, maybe I'll actually send this over to them and see if they notice. You know, they'll put it up on the wall and won't notice it straight away. So that was my plan. But in the end, what happened was I had Steve Lazaridis, who you met, came around the studio and one day with Damien Hirst and various others, and they saw it and said, "Yeah, we should do something fun with this." And so he ended up. So that was about 2007. So it was just the start of things going viral. It hadn't happened to any of my work before, but because Steve was doing Banksy and all the street artists at that time, and had this network of underground websites and bloggers and everything. So it went all over the world in a couple of days, and so which was fun, but it lost that element of surprise, because obviously the White House were getting rung up for comments about it.
I love it. I love the story. Okay, so you've done that. I thought that for a portrait painter to do this is quite avant-garde. Then next thing, when I met you at the time, you have just completed your plastic surgeon. series. So don't you think that now is more appropriate than and then during the time? Because now, I mean, doing plastic surgery is so common. So what makes you do the plastic surgery series?
That's a good question. So it was actually one of my surgeon friends who was a kind of artist in his spare time who pointed this out to me. And I thought he challenged me. He said, you know, if Leonardo was alive now, this is the subject matter he would be most interested in, because it's, you know, it's cutting edge of medical science on the one hand, but it's also unnecessary. You know, people aren't doing it to fix problems, fix something that's wrong with them. They're making changes to their body, which are aesthetic judgments about what's going to make them happier. And sometimes it's the aesthetic judgment of the surgeon rather than the subject. So that bit was interesting. There was also the interest that, when he started showing me the kind of pictures, the material and the patients and that before the surgery, they mark the bodies with what they're going to do. And I like that particularly because that was, on the one hand, obviously, you know, it's literally a surgeon as an artist making, you know, using the human body as a canvas. But then, of course, there's the slight implied, you know, violence, really, of the fact that these casual sort of felt tip marks were where a knife was going to be going through a few hours later. And so you had this sense of, like, you know, the impending, you know, drama to come. And then I also obviously liked the idea of going, being allowed in to watch the cosmetic surgery operations, the facelifts, because I've spent so much of my life watching, looking at faces from, you know, the normal way around, see how they work underneath, I thought would be really interesting, which it was. But I think so all these reasons made me really keen to do it. But I think in the end of the day, what was most interesting and why I do go back to it every few years is that it's the psychology of it, which is, you know, one of the reasons people feel the need to do these procedures, which are expensive and sometimes risky or, you know, don't always go according to plan. Or people get addicted to it and then sort of like, you know, keep doing it. You know, there's so many elements of psychology. Like, you know, what are the pressures we feel from society, or is it we feel it from ourselves? Everyone's obsessed with sort of aging, and that seems to be the underlying kind of common theme. But also then you dig a bit deeper and find that there's, you know, at different parts of the world people do different things. You know, in Europe people want to do it, but they make it as subtle as possible because they don't want to advertise the fact they've been doing it. But in actually Eastern Europe or, you know, Brazil and places like that, they're very happy for it to be noticeable because it's a fashion thing. So that was really interesting. And then you get the sort of trends of, you know, different, slightly different looks. In the sort of mid-noughties, it was like to have, you know, massive obvious breast enhancements and certain things which were sort of, you know, of the time. And then it went, you know, the other way. And then in recent years, it's been much more about sort of gender reassignments and kind of, you know, things, you know, surgery to do with sort of, other things going on in society. You know, people kind of removing traces of, you know, their sexuality at all by removing their nipples and things like that recently. So I think there's an interesting thing where this, you know, surgery is actually a predictor of cultural shifts in, you know, society.
Wow. Okay. Then I saw your recent work when I last came. I really like it. And then explain, because you are using a lot of technology as well.
Yes.
To create those work. So explain those work, because it's really interesting, because I always thought, oh, Johnny is portraitry. I want to do a show with Johnny, but portraitry is not really my gallery thing. Mm. And then when I saw those, I thought, brilliant.
Mm. So, I've always been a little bit of a geek and always interested in trying new technologies, whether it's sort of like just camera capturing or I got into sort of three-dimensional capturing 7 or 8 years ago, and then I worked with Google on a 3D drawing software which they were developing, and ended up using that for a different purpose than it was intended by working with Pangolin, and we ended up using it to design a sculpture which hadn't been done. That was the bronze, which is downstairs you saw, which was in the show at the Royal Academy. We just made it in time for their 250th anniversary show. And so I kind of carried on experimenting with the ways of using new technologies to, you know, do portraiture in different ways. And those works, the latest lot of work, has actually been experiments going on for several years, but it's around you doing 3D capture but getting it wrong. So using handheld 3D scanners and deliberately messing it up so that, you know, the algorithms can't work out what it's trying to capture. And I love the fact that some of them would come out almost like abstract expressionist paintings. Mm-hmm. But you can still see some of the digital artifacts. And I'm still working out how much to use them, you know, in the pure digital form, how much to, I mean, I've tried doing it like that. I've been done some as paintings. I think probably the work which hopefully we might end up showing is it will be stuff which combines the two, so it's got a bit of the digital and a bit of painting. But I just love, and there's also this sort of that thing of paradox of progress, that the technology gets better but doesn't necessarily improve the outcomes you're looking for. So basically, I went back recently to make some more scans in the same way, thinking about, I've got an idea now to do some new ones. And they've upgraded all the software, they've upgraded the cameras, and now they, because they were all self-portraits, they all look like me. And so it's like, I can't, that moment in time a few years ago when I made all those scans, which luckily I've kept a lot of them, was before the technology was good enough to do what it was trying to do. So actually, it's sort of...
So it's just like stop in time.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's this like, progress doesn't always, get you better results than the sort of earlier stages of it. And so I think that's quite a nice little story about technology as well. It doesn't always get better.
And how about AI? Are you thinking that AI would enhance your, will help you, would inspire you, or completely taking all that away?
I mean that's a, we could do a whole podcast just on AI. I think I've sort of dabbled in AI for quite a few years and always found it quite disappointing. I can see what the potential of it might be one day, but then suddenly, obviously, in the last couple of years with sort of Midjourney and those sort of things, it's got a lot better quicker. We've done various experiments trying to teach, train an AI model on my style, and it's got better at replicating the style, but what it can't do is work out the faces. It can't make the same judgments about a face that, it doesn't know which bits to exaggerate, distort, keep the same. Although it did do an interesting project recently with Snapchat, where they trained, they because they've got very, obviously you've got a big team doing AI, but also their app, their platform is all about portraiture. I know the CEO, and Evan, and we talked about this relationship between his technology and portraiture, and they trained an AI model on my work, and the results have been really good because it seems to have learnt the style quite well, but also keeps the sort of features of the face in the right way, and so that is something which I think they're going to be launching soon, and I can show you some of the.
I would love to see. So. You are saying that actually AI actually is supporting your work.
I'm ambivalent about it because I think this. I think it'll make artists lazy. But I think that the fact you can get results so quickly, and it's an amazing way of trying out ideas. Almost always what it throws up isn't what you were looking for. Sometimes it's more interesting. Often it's just a bit weird, but it's I think there's a danger with AI, not just in kind of my area, but in music and everything else, that it'll make us a bit lazy and less imaginative ourselves. I think that's the danger. It's not necessarily a certainty. I think it'll take a lot of work away from graphic artists and storyboard artists and all that sort of thing. It's already happening. I think it's potentially an interesting tool. I mean, I think I'm not scared of it. Some people are scared of it. I think it'll be a tool that we start using a lot, that like Photoshop's become that, but I think it needs to be treated with caution. I think the other thing that worries me is, is that, as visual artists, probably my work, certainly a lot of artists' work has been used to train these models. None of the artists get any recognition or credit for that. And there are lots of, big AI companies now making a huge amount of money out of it all. I think that feels a bit unfair to me.
That is absolutely right. But, but you are using hand to do the work. So a lot of conceptual artists will be absolutely killed because the AI can do the job, right? Because if you think about conceptual artists, most of the work is not done by the hand, it's by someone else. Then all of a sudden, is because AI can do so many other artworks. So your hand, your craft becomes so much more important.
Yeah. I think it'll be interesting to see how it evolves. I think that I like to think that it'll evolve in a way that your drawing and what you make is enhanced rather than the AI doing the whole thing for you. Because I think that's where it's more interesting. And there's some artists who've done some really interesting experiments around that. There's a guy called Scott Eaton who does brilliant things using generative adversarial networks. Mm. You've got artists. Obviously there's people like Rafiq Anadol who are doing something different. Again, I remember going to his studio in LA before COVID and being amazed at the sort of scale of his
operation. Oh, did you see his work when he was doing it 2 years ago here?
Yes, I've seen that one.
The Lux or whatever. Yeah. It was amazing. How do you see portraiture going to be in the next centuries?
That's a really interesting
because,
question.
Because, we have the photograph. Yeah. When the photograph came out, all the portraiture styles change. And you don't need to paint people as it is. You paint the character, the personality, their spirit, whatever.
Yeah.
So the realistic, whether the portrait looks realistic or not, is no longer important. Mm. But what you are doing is you take in the classical way of interpreting, but you put something different in. So what do you think in the future with the AI, with all that thing, with all that technology coming out?
Yeah, I think it will change, but I think some things will stay consistent. So, and funny, I'm one of the other hats I wear is I'm on the board of the National Portrait Gallery in London, and one of the things we're having to think about at the moment is how to anticipate how AI and other technologies are going to affect the kind of position and portraiture in the coming years and the type of work that's going to be made. It's difficult. I'd say if I was to make general predictions, I'd say that our relationship with photography will shift. I think it's already happening because
happening.
It's become so much more disposable than every day. I take my kids to the National Portrait Gallery and they're not really interested in looking at photos because they see them as disposable things that they just like go through your social media feed. They love the paintings, the sort of physical things that have been made. And I think there'll be so many new ways of capturing that the photography will seem, I think, as a sort of slightly, will seem like a 20th century thing. If I was to make a prediction, I'd say that the three-dimensional world will become a much bigger thing in the 21st century.
Absolutely.
So sculpture, architecture, virtual works. I think it'll get so much easier to...
3D film.
Exactly. I think basically it's been harder. You needed more resources in the 20th century to make 3D works. It was expensive, you needed space, you needed the materials. And you needed to be someone to believe in this sort of vision that you had. Whereas you'll be able to design things really fast in VR, show it to someone, and if they commit to it, then you can make these fabulous things. And there'll be more ways of viewing them. We just got the Apple Vision headset, which they sent
us.
It's
very heavy. I tried on.
It's a bit heavy. It'll get better in the next few years, and people will start using these things like they use their phones now. And I think that will change the sort of content we can consume in lots of ways. In terms of how portraiture changes, I like to think that there's still going to be a sort of a value in the authenticity of the sense of like something that's been made as a document of a relationship between two people. It'll get easier and easier to say Pearl Lamb portrait in Jonathan Yeo or Pablo Picasso or Mark Quinn or whatever the style is, and it'll come out, spit it out like that. But I think that it'll be lacking that sense of the real experience that was there, and the AI, I think, is many decades away from really, really thinking and understanding the emotional, understanding we have and the baggage we bring and the cultural references we have when making something. It's just a remix engine, basically. So I think that the kind of, the human...
Interesting, huh?
Yeah, the document of the human relationship being done in a way... But I suspect it'll end up constantly reacting to new technologies and, kind of weaving
a way
around
it. Because it's a contemporary world. You always evolve in accordingly with today's technology.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Johnny, you have been painting all these prominent figures and all these, famous people. So who will be the one that you really wanted to paint? Give me a word per person, and how long do you need to know that person, sit with that person, that you can paint their emotional level or their personality reflecting?
I should have an answer for this, because I do sometimes get asked. I don't go around with a sort of like a hit list of people I'd like to paint more than others. I guess there's certain types. I think I'm interested in sometimes accidental political figures, people who've ended up affecting the world, but not necessarily by choice. I've painted Malala Yousafzai and Doreen Lawrence and a few others who have become influential figures. I guess at the moment you look at people like Greta Thunberg or Zelensky and people who kind of like been thrust into positions or kind of like ended up in positions where they're becoming sort of, you know, actors on a world stage. I think the people, like the things I enjoy most is painting other artists in terms of just the process itself. Because I always learn stuff from it. You know, Peter Blake and Damien Hirst and Grayson Perry and various other artist friends. I've always trying to persuade Tracy Emin to sit for me, but she's kind of she hasn't succumbed so far to my persuasion. But there are quite a few artists, some of like Tracy who I know, but also others who I don't know. I like their work, and I'd be really interested to see how they're, you know, what they're like to spend time with, and whether, you know, part of the process is you discover who people are, and generally you like them more at the end of it, but sometimes you like them less, you know, or they turn out to be very different from what you expect.
Do you have someone that after you paint, you know, have several seating and you just couldn't wait to kick them out?
Yes, quite a few. I can't tell you who they are.
So did you kick them out?
Well, I certainly kind of rushed to finish things when I haven't been enjoying them. But that doesn't happen so much. That was more early in life, I think, because nowadays I'm in the kind of lucky position that there are a lot more people wanting me to paint them than I've got time to do. I can't speed up just because more people want it, which means I end up being a bit more choosy about who I paint. And that, so I try to either make sure they come, yeah, that someone I know knows them, or if they come to me cold, that I get, you know, get them on the phone or get to meet them and just get a sense of them before committing to it. Because usually the sort of people who come and think of doing a portrait are sort of unusual and quirky and interesting people. But if you get it wrong, or worst of all, if you just find it boring, if there's no spark between you, then the process is boring and it ends up with a bad picture and it takes too long. And so you have to try and weed out the ones you don't think you're going to enjoy, basically.
Every day you're going around and you must be seeing a lot of different faces, you know, especially you're traveling around. Mm. Don't you want to paint one of those faces? And if you do, what do you do? You will go up to them and say, will you come for my city? Yeah. Actually, I don't have time.
I did a bit of that early on in life. And, you know, some people would often like think, who's this weirdo? These days, I'm just staring at people, trying to figure out what's interesting about their faces. If I'm with my kids, they get embarrassed because I'm, you know, staring at strangers in public who then notice I'm staring at them. But I should say I don't just paint sort of famous people. I mean, they tend to be the ones that get talked about, but that's probably only about 20% of what I do. I often paint friends, family, and sometimes people I meet who I just think are interesting, which I inevitably what you're looking for in a subject is someone who is interesting and also has an interesting face. The two things often go together, but not always. But when you meet someone like that, you try and find a way of getting them in to be part of the, you know, to be in a picture.
Thank you, Johnny, for having us here. And it is a wonderful talking to you.
Thank you, Barbara. It's a great honour, as always.
Thank you.